You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Hello there, and welcome to Mysteries and Monsters. Before I dive into this week's show, I just wanted to express my sadness on the sudden passing of cryptozoologist Scott Mardis. Scott was someone I had gotten to know through Mysteries and Monsters, and we had been trying to arrange an interview for quite a while. Scott focused particularly on lake and sea cryptids, and he will be dearly missed by many. Our sincere condolences to Scott's family and friends. As for today's show, and this week, I'm joined by the comedian and the host of the Monstrosity podcast, David Race. David's show is a mixture of pop culture and cryptids with a dash of the paranormal and has had guests from film, TV and music, alongside some notable investigators such as Matt Moneymaker, Linda Godfrey and more. We discuss his favourite guests from Batman star Burt Ward, Catherine Back from Dukes of Hazzard, and the legendary Genesis guitarist and member Steve Hackett before discussing his own personal Class B Bigfoot encounter in upstate New York, missing 411 cases, and much more. A big thank you to David for joining me on this week's show. As always, you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up for our Patreon in this week's show notes for $4 a month for ad-free episodes, early releases, and our bonus content in the Paranormal Archive. Check out the show notes to sign up today. Mysteries and Monsters can be found across all social media platforms. We're on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and please subscribe to our YouTube, where we finally climbed the mountain of 1,000 subscribers. So thank you to everybody that has recently subscribed. Artwork for the show, as always, is by Dean Bestall. The show is produced by Brennan Storr from the Ghost Story Guys. And Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. And now, to join this week's guest, David Race. On this week's show, I am joined by the multi-talented David Race. Comedian, host, TV and podcast creator, David has as many fingers in pies as a Kraken's tentacle, and is currently hosts the marvellous Monstrosity podcast, and when the pandemics lift, continues to perform comedy around LA's most notable venues. David, I am delighted to welcome you to the show. Thank you for joining me.
Great to be here, Paul.
David, your show, as I touched on in the introduction when I got through it, is a very unique mix and blend, which is something, when you've worked in this kind of field, you've been very adept at bringing out. And I'm really interested in what the germination process is in regards to your format, in regards to how you settled on that kind of mixture.
Mixture meaning the comedy and the paranormal combined. I'm assuming you mean that.
Yes.
Well, it goes back actually to my old podcast. I had a podcast before Monstrosity, Comedians Talking About Bigfoot. And that one, I mean, the title was self-explanatory. I told you point blank what it's going to be. But that was born out of, the longer version, I guess, is that I was a radio guy, a disc jockey in New York and Philadelphia for a long time before I ever became a comedian. And at some point about 2015, every comedian I knew in LA had a podcast except me. And it wasn't because I couldn't get one or what, I was resisting doing one. I had in my head this idea that, I'm not going to do a podcast. I've already been a radio guy in New York. To me, it didn't make any sense. I was thinking, this is turf I already treaded on. Like, I'm not going to go do that now. Like, it doesn't make any sense. And so I kept resisting. And then at some point I was, talking to a friend of mine, comedian friend of mine about Bigfoot on the phone. And I was, I have a knowledge and passion about that topic. And by that time I had had my own Bigfoot incident, and we're on the phone and we're having this what turned into a really funny but interesting, you know, conversation about Bigfoot. You know, he was laughing a lot. And he was kind of a good, you know, second banana to what I was talking about. And it just all came together naturally in a phone call where I thought to myself, this is a podcast. Like if I take this phone call and I actually turn this phone call into a podcast, this is a really unique podcast. It's not just the David Ray show or the John Johnson show or the whatever other comic out there had a show. Mm. It's a more unique picture frame to hang the podcast in. So I'm quickly threw together the idea that let me do that. And I went to a studio and, you know, came up with a, you know, agreement to do the show at their studio. And I started booking, comics that I know around LA, who were all very conditioned to being on other comics podcasts. So that wasn't difficult to get them to show up and do that.
Yeah.
I started booking them to come on my show. And I thought immediately the format, you know, came to me that it would be me and a couple comedians I know, the ever changing comedians, you know, week to week. And then on the phone would be a Bigfoot person, whether it's, you know, completely not famous person, but they have a great Bigfoot incident in Michigan or wherever it was, or whether it's an actual person that is known from television, you know, that's seen regularly on that show or this show. You know, that would be, to me, that was like even better, but whoever it was, whether it was an anonymous person or a famous person, they would be a Bigfoot person. And we would have this conversation that would veer between, you know, serious discussion of what, you know, they know and what they've seen and what's going on in their Bigfoot, you know, landscape. And there would also inevitably, I just knew I wouldn't even have to try that hard for there to be funny moments, because just with me hosting, I knew I'd inadvertently say things that were off the cuff funny. And then on top of that, I was putting two more comedians in the room who would be even less likely to keep it together. So I knew the comedy was just going to happen on its own. And then the interview segment would, you know, hopefully be, you know, somewhat, you know, spooky and titillating and interesting. Well, anyway, it worked exactly as I envisioned it. And then by the seventh episode of that show, it got a TV development deal.
Mm.
So that podcast didn't last very long before I ran off to do television. And then the television thing tied me up like a year, maybe a little more than that. It didn't end up airing. It became, you know, like one of the majority of things that happens in LA, became a very expensive, elaborately done, you know, time wasting pilot that no one's ever seen.
Yes.
But once that whole period of my life was over, and I was back to sort of, you know, no TV development deal and no podcast,
yeah.
I thought, let me do a podcast again. And I thought to myself, this time, similar to the previous one, but let me go with celebrities instead of comedians.
Mm.
So just, you know, swap out the couple of comics, replace that with celebrity. You know, title now, you know, switches from comedians talking about Bigfoot to monstrosity with David Race, you know, playing on the word monster and the fact that the show is such a thrown together weird combination of things. It's a monstrosity. And I knew the monstrosity, the word monstrosity, I immediately saw that it would make an interesting logo, that the letters in it could be played with. The O could be a UFO, the S can be a sea serpent. Yeah, I knew there was ways to play with the letters. So we, you know, I threw that together, me and my assistant, you know, and I got a different studio this time to record that, closer to my house, thank God. And we started doing the episodes. So the very first episode of Monstrosity is actually not anyone famous. It's me and the two comedians that I had cast in the pilot that I did on from the other show, because I thought it would be smart to come back in with the new podcast and explain basically to my audience where I've been.
Yes.
So I just grabbed the two comics that were on the pilot with me and had us tell the story of the pilot. And, you know, this is why comedians talking about Bigfoot vanished after seven episodes. It wasn't that David was in the witness protection program. It's we were busy doing this other thing, and let's tell you the whole story about it. We basically let everyone in on the secret.
Yeah.
And I knew we had a couple of great, really funny stories, more than a couple. We told, but we highlighted a couple of the best ones from that road trip that was involved in the shooting of the pilot. So that became episode one of Monstrosity. And then, in the first few episodes, I didn't necessarily get any significant celebrity to come in because it took, you had to establish the show a little bit.
Yeah.
But by episode three, I think it was, we had Matt Moneymaker. And then episode four, we had some Seinfeld people. Mm. Episode five is Brody Stevens, who in what turns out to be one of his very last interviews ever.
Yeah.
In episode six, we have Peter Brady from the Brady Bunch, Christopher Knight, which was a thrill to me because every kid in America grew up seeing the Brady Bunch on reruns nonstop at school every day. You know, yeah. And I said to him on the show, I said, Chris, do you understand that you're actually one of the most famous people in TV history? And he goes, how so? And I said, you've been on TV nonstop in the United States for 50 years.
Yeah.
You've never been off television. Like every generation, I don't care if it's a 25-year-old or a 60-year-old, knows who you are. Mm. The only other people that get that kind of fame are gigantic movie stars or, people who play James Bond or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And he seemed like kind of taken aback by, I am that famous. Yeah. he sort of seemed surprised by his own – I startled him with his own fame. not long after that, we had Lonnie Anderson come in, Lonnie Anderson was legendarily famous here in the United States in the early 80s. And yep. He's married to Burt Reynolds, for God's sakes. Burt Reynolds was as big a star as you can be.
Absolutely.
That would be like, for the younger half of the audience, that would be like having Angelina Jolie on or something. And she was married to Brad Pitt. This is a very famous person. Mm-hmm. And then Robert Carradine from Revenge of the Nerds was within. We had Daisy Duke, Catherine Bach from Dukes of Hazzard, which was a huge show in the United States in the 80s. Steve Hackett from Genesis is one of the highlights of my career because I'm the world's biggest Genesis fan.
Yeah.
I mean, I was in a fan club. I was in a Genesis fan club in the early 80s as a teenager. I was in a Genesis fan club that used to send me these – stapled together Genesis fan magazines every few months that they made.
And
I paid the little membership dues, and they would send me, this Genesis fan magazine. It was 20 pages with all the latest news about Genesis and this, really old school typewriter font,
Yes.
And I waited for that thing arriving like normal kids waited for a Playboy. And this was the most exciting thing in the world to me.
Yeah.
So, I was so into Genesis and so into Steve Hackett, Daryl Sturmer, Mike Rutherford, that I used to muck around with a guitar and fancy myself a guitar player. And by the way, I'm going to use all British lingo in this conversation. I used to muck about and fancy myself. Who am I? Peter Gabriel? Listen to how I'm speaking. but I used to play around with a guitar as a teenager, not very well, but I would play around and I'd play Genesis stuff in my bedroom. And I was so into these guys that anytime I'd go see them on tour, I had to have the guitar they were using. So as Mike Rutherford switched from, a Roland, a blue Roland guitar to a black Steinberger guitar, teenage me had to run out and trade in his Roland to buy a black Steinberger. Yeah. Because I had to have the most up-to-date Mike Rutherford guitar.
Yes.
And so having Steve Hackett on was mind-blowing to me. The idea that you could be walking down the street today, somewhere in London, and bump into Steve Hackett in a coffee shop, and that you could say to him, I heard you on David Race's show. The fact that Steve Hackett's response to you would be, David Race, I like the guy, enjoyed the show. The fact that he would know who I am is mind-boggling to me. Because there were posters of Steve Hackett on my wall right next to the Daisy Duke posters when I was growing up. and then we had Mike Damone from Fast Times at Ridgemont High, which I spent the whole episode telling him that he doesn't realize he stole this movie from Sean Penn. This movie was supposed to be Sean Penn's breakout movie. You got Forrest Whitaker in there. You got Judge Reinhold, a lot of famous people.
Yeah.
Robert Romanus, who played Mike Damone, steals the movie. He just takes the movie out from under them and leaves them all in a hole. And I explained this to him, and he also seemed puzzled by his own success. We've had Tanya Ramone from Billy Bob Thornton's Amazon show, Goliath.
Yep.
She's this amazingly beautiful girl, plays like a hooker paralegal on that show. And we had her in, and I got her to play a game of F, Marry, Kill, basically, with monsters in it, you know. And I got her to outright say that she would have sex with Dogman. And I really kept reconditioning her to the answer. Like, do you understand what you're admitting here? I want to just make sure I've clarified that I understand too, that you understand that you've just agreed to consummate with a dog man. And you're going to marry Bigfoot. You're going to dismiss Loch Ness Monster, but you've agreed to consummate with a dog man. And she thought about it, and she said, and this is one of the most beautiful women in the United States. She looks at me, and 3 feet away from me in the room, and she's with those doe eyes of hers, and she says to me, yeah, no, I understand. That's what I said. And I'm thinking to myself, this girl's career just ended. I'm thinking, like, I just ended this girl's career. I felt terrible for her. Now, thankfully, I have not ended her career. She went on to do Deep Blue Sea 3 after that, and as far as I know, Goliath is coming back, and yeah, she's still working, but I don't know how she's still working after that admission. Shadow Stevens, he was one of those famous disc jockey spokesman type guys, and he was on a sitcom here, yeah, 3 years in the United States, and then we had the cast of Land of the Lost, which was an old 70s show that we all grew up watching, paranormal, one of our first paranormal shows as a kid if you're a certain age.
Yeah.
Katrina Weidman from Travel Channel's on that show. They had the same episode. We had one of the original MTV VJs on, Alan Hunter. We had Audrey Landers, who was this beautiful woman that used to be on the TV show Dallas here in the United States. She was, yeah, on with Dave Schrader from another ghost television show. Mm-hmm. And recently we had Burt Ward from Batman and the original Robin,
yep,
who was the greatest dog food salesman I've ever heard in my life. He was pitching us his Gentle Giant dog food. And I didn't have a dog at the time, and I went out and bought Gentle Giant dog food. I mean, and now I'm worried because I got a bag of Gentle Giant dog food, and I've got a terrier mix dog that's not very big, and I'm worried if I feed her this food, she's going to become a giant. And then we've got – we had Steve Lukather from Toto on the current episode that's, yeah, you know, still playing right now. I mean, that guy – let's talk about legendary guitar players, but Steve Lukather's on like 1,000 albums. He's on so many albums that like people don't realize that Steve Lukather they're hearing all the time. Yeah. All different famous guitar parts that people, you know, take for granted and hear every day are Steve Lukather. The most glaring example is – everyone knows Michael Jackson's Beat It.
Yeah.
And everyone, you know, if you talk about Beat It, the first thing people will say when they talk about that song is, well, that's Eddie Van Halen on that song, you know, because Eddie Van Halen got all the press for playing the big guitar solo on Beat It. Yeah. But the actual riff that carries the song, yeah, is all Steve Lukather.
Yeah.
And on that same episode, we have Bill Burns from Ancient Aliens. And I got to say, I think the best UFO interview I've ever heard anyone do on Earth with Bill Burns. Mm. I really came up with questions for this guy.
Yeah.
I walked out of that room patting myself on the back to the point where I couldn't drive. I had no available hands because of the incredible questions I was asking Bill Burns. I was so proud of the questions I came up with. We just recorded a new episode yesterday, and your audience is right now going to hear about it for the first time. I haven't talked about it on my own social media. No one in my audience even knows who's on it, but we just recorded a new episode yesterday. It was Richard Klein from the TV show Three's Company, which was like probably the biggest show on TV in the United States in the 80s, late 70s, 80s with Suzanne Somers and John Ritter. Mm. Richard Klein was the next door neighbor, John Ritter's wingman, Larry Dallas.
Yes.
And he was, you know, the sleazy used car salesman, like playboy guy that was always like, you know, trolling around the bars with John Ritter's character, picking up women, you know. And And similar to the Mike Damone character from Fast Times, a similar kind of iconic, interesting character like that. And then the paranormal person on the show is the return of Matt Moneymaker.
Ah.
And Matt and I end up having an hour-long, really, really detailed discussion that we just recorded. And a lot of it's about UFOs. Mm. It's by far the most UFO talk you'll ever hear Matt Moneymaker do. By far. And that's on the new episode that will be coming along about first week of July.
Brilliant. Fantastic. I mean, it is very interesting as well, because especially when you're talking about the reach that celebrities have, David, I think sometimes, as you refer to there, a couple of your guests are still unaware just how constant they are in certain people's mindsets. Because, you know, Burt Ward, for us here in the UK as well, is someone that I grew up with synonymously. Saturday mornings, school holidays, Batman was always on. There was always like an argument in the school holidays when my cousin used to come and stay with us, because he wanted to watch Zorro and I wanted to watch Batman. So, you know, even here in the UK, from sort of the late 70s throughout the 80s, you know, Adam West and Burt Ward and all the wonderful guest stars, and especially somebody that's obsessed with Vincent Price as I am. You know, I remember his highlight when he played Egghead in Batman and things like that. So I find it incredible sometimes that these people who are often out of the public eye are still so well known, because they become so ingrained in the cultural zeitgeist, and yet it continues to go on. Because, you know, we're talking, you know, Batman ran for four seasons, I think it was, in the mid to late 60s. Was the biggest show in the world for two or three years until, you know, they made a business decision, I think, as Bert referred to in your interview to him, to pull the show. And yet people still know who he is.
Well, it's the syndication. I mean, you know, you were seeing these marathons of Batman growing up, and, you know, certainly you weren't watching during its original run, but you are watching it, you know, many years later. So they're still running left and right. And same thing here in the United States. Bert was on after school, a lot like the Brady Bunch. It was one of those shows you'd see after school here. So you'd come home from school as a 13-year-old or 11-year-old, and, you know, at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you'd have, you know, the Brady Bunch and Batman and, you know, Gilligan's Island. There's certain shows that sort of were ever present.
Yeah.
And yeah, Batman is definitely one of them. So, I mean, I saw all those too. And, you know, anyone in their right mind, I mean, one of the most compelling things about the Batman show, it was a great show, but one of the most compelling things about it, who can forget this Julie Newmar? Yeah. I mean, for God's sakes, Julie Newmar is so unbelievably attractive that I found myself watching on Amazon recently, I forget what the heck the show's called, some show she did before Batman. It was a black and white sitcom where she plays like a robot or an alien or something that I can't remember. I think it's a robot that just lives with this regular single guy. Like, you know, it's always the 60s were full of these shows. Like, yeah. I Dream of Jeannie, like this, where it's sort of this guy and the most beautiful woman in the world. And but the show is very not overly sexual, which is it's not the complete porn show that it would be today.
Yes.
Same construct, you know. And she plays, you know, like this robot with this, you know, average guy, you know, he's sort of like hiding her out. Like, no one's supposed to know about you. Get back in that closet, that kind of thing. A lot like Jeannie.
Yeah.
You know? And she's just the most stunning woman in history. And, you know, one of the secret things that Julie Newmar had, and I tried to get Bert to talk about this, but he was ducking out of the way of my Julie Newmar questions in that Bert Ward interview.
Yeah.
I threw a few at him. I kept coming back to it, but he kept ducking out of the way. But one of the secrets with Julie Newmar's beauty is that she was a dancer.
Yeah.
And there's something about women who were dancers, who were professional caliber dancers, that they sashay into a room, you know, they pirouette into the scene in a certain way.
Yeah.
It's not a normal walk. It's not a regular beautiful woman's, you know, physicality. There's something highly unusual and special about the way Julie Newmar enters a scene. Watch for that, careful.
I will. It is interesting, like you touched on there. There's something about that midpoint in the 60s that there are so many weird programs. I mean, one of my favourites from that period, I know you mentioned I Dream of Jeannie, but obviously there was programs like Bewitched, The Munsters, The Addams Family, yeah. And these were sort of regular family comedy entertainments, but they had a very unusual paranormal slant, because this day and age, I mean, these days, there obviously are probably several examples of something similar, but it seems that that 60s point, David, was a real high end for that kind of attempt to try and do something a little bit different and play with the sitcom, because obviously American television is synonymous with the sitcom, and probably the best example recently has been Marvel's WandaVision, especially the first couple of episodes, which I know some people say, oh, well, I've never seen I Love Lucy or Bewitched, and you're like, but anybody who, like me, was babysat by older siblings was basically fed a diet of Lucille Ball and Elizabeth Montgomery as a small child. Once again, similar to what you were talking about in regards to Batman on reruns, because they were shown all the time over here. You know, early mornings, mid afternoons, especially in the 80s.
I was about to say, it's not just after school, because when in the US, when you would be home sick from school, these were the shows you'd be seeing all day.
Yes.
So you know, yes, 11 a.m. and noon and things like that. These were not just after school, but if you were home, you know, as a 12-year-old in the United States, sick from school with a cold or something, that is what you saw: Bewitched and I Love Lucy and Jeannie and et cetera, et cetera. That's what you saw all day.
Yeah, and and I think it's a real high point as well, because like I say, it's a very interesting period, because these aren't the kind of topics you would expect to be covered. And like you say, it's very odd how that kind of developed. But then when you get into the 70s and 80s, it kind of really dropped off the market, especially in America. I mean, we've never really tried anything over here similarly to that, really, in the UK in regards to that. You know, often they've copied some American TV shows. And obviously these days, ideas fly back and forth across the Atlantic, with different shows kicking off either side and then, you know, being remade for each individual market, David. So, you know, when you get your guests on, I think it is a little bit surprising to some of them that, you know, their reach is beyond the United States as well.
Right. Well, I mean, certain celebrities that we have on, I think, you know, probably realize that the international reach and understand that, the rock stars in particular. And Steve Lukather knows he's in a major rock band. He's also in Ringo's band, and he's played on a bazillion albums. So Steve Lukather knows that, you know, from Germany to Germantown, Pennsylvania, everyone knows who this is. You know? But guys that were on American TV shows, women that were on American TV shows, it could be harder for them to realize, well, I guess they know me in Italy too. I mean, but it really sometimes depends what show it was. I don't know why I think this. Maybe I'm wrong, but the TV show Dallas seems like it might actually have been an international sensation more than I would think. Am I right? So Audrey Landers, who I had on, and she played Afton Cooper on Dallas, beautiful blonde woman on Dallas, and she was on most of the series run. So she's probably pretty well known internationally also.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Dallas, I think until fairly recently, was the highest viewed international show in the UK, because when JR got shot,
right,
the country stopped here in the UK. It was massive, you know, here, Dallas.
Here too. I, remember, I was a kid, and I still remember that was a big deal. And I was not really old enough to care that much, but I remember that was a big deal. Yeah. It was world stopping.
Yeah, and like Catherine Back, I remember The Dukes of Hazzard as a young lad growing up. Obviously, I'm going to remember Daisy Duke as a young man.
Yeah, who would forget? Yeah, she's a great example of the iconic. That's another thing that's interesting about the guests I've had come in. I said this yesterday on the episode I was recording yesterday. The show is starting to tend towards specialize in iconic celebrities. It's really iconic people that I'm getting come in a lot. It's not so far been about, you know, the latest cast member from the latest show. Sure, Tanya Ramon was on it. I have no aversion to having somebody on from a current show. I'm not complaining at all or turning them down. But the show seems to specialize so far in iconic people. I mean, Daisy Duke is one of those great example, because she's then even the shorts that she wore on the show are still used in the vernacular today.
Yeah.
You know, you could talk to an 18-year-old girl today and she'll know the phrase Daisy Dukes in reference to a pair of shorts, but she won't even realize where that phrase came from.
Yeah.
And it came from Catherine's shorts. You know, so Catherine's still the inspiration for a pair of shorts some 21-year-old girl's wearing today that she doesn't even realize that's why they're called that.
You know, I can still remember the characters, you know, Boss Hogg and Roscoe P. Coltrane and Uncle Jesse and things like that. And this is a show we're talking probably, you know, it started 40 years ago.
I used to have a joke in my stand-up back many years ago when Boss Hogg died in real life. I was doing a stand-up show like that night, I think, and I just ad-libbed this line and it went over really well. And then I kept doing it for like weeks. It was something along the lines of, I saw in the news that Boss Hogg from Dukes of Hazzard died today. I'm shocked. He always seemed so healthy. I mean, you know, the guy did every scene with a piece of fried chicken in his hand.
Yeah.
I talked about Steve Hackett being a highlight of my career. Having Steve Hackett on the show was mind-boggling. But I shouldn't forget to mention that having Catherine on, Daisy Duke, for God's sake, I am the only person I've ever heard ask her this. I asked her to detail for me what was under the shorts. And not only did I get answers from her about her underwear, but then she whipped out her phone and started showing me pictures of her underwear. So if you listen to the Daisy Duke episode, there's a point in the first few minutes where we're talking about this, and I become nearly speechless while having Daisy Duke scroll through her phone showing me pictures of her underwear. I was barely able to function and continue the rest of the program. That alone, you know, if there's a big payoff from having, you know, done this podcast, that's it right there. How many people have gotten to sit next to Catherine Bach and have her scroll through pictures of her underwear?
Well, yeah, that's certainly probably one of the unexpected situations. Yeah. I would imagine growing up, David, you never thought you'd find yourself in.
Yeah, I mean, in cases like that, it's literally the poster from my teenage wall walked in, sat next to me, and decided to scroll through underwear with me.
I mean, the other aspect of this is as well is, when you create this kind of concept and you have this caliber of guest on, as you refer to, because these are people who play iconic roles who may not realise that they are thought of as in that way by the viewers and the public out there, David. How easy are you sometimes concerned about turning the conversation to more paranormal and Fortean topics, how the guest's going to take it, or do you find it quite easy? Because I think sometimes, especially anybody who's been an actor, perhaps who's worked in the theatre as well as film or television, will often have an anecdote or a story about a haunted location or something like that. But when you're talking about things like aliens and cryptozoology and Bigfoot, do you sometimes think that they're just going to shut you down? Or are you surprised at how often your guests embrace these topics and seem genuinely interested in what you're talking about in regards to these?
That's a great question, because it is a concern of mine, actually, pretty much going into every episode. And I've been surprised at how many celebrities we've had on that it turned out had their own story they wanted to share. I've been surprised by that, because it's not a requirement. When we book the show, we don't write to Lonnie Anderson, you know, you must have something to say on the paranormal. Now, do you? Or, you know, if you don't, you're not getting in here. You know, we don't say that to Lonnie Anderson. She's booked, you know, and we don't make it at all a requirement. In fact, we even say to them something along the lines of, don't worry about that stuff. We'll handle that. You know, you just come in and we'll interview you. And, you know, we've got that base covered, basically. But it keeps surprising me that more than a handful, if not the majority of celebrities we've had in, have had their own paranormal thing they want to share. Burt Ward had stuff to say on that front. Kenny Banya from Seinfeld, Steve Heitner, if I recall, had something. definitely Lonnie Anderson talked about being stalked by Jane Mansfield's ghost.
Yeah.
She was filming the Jane Mansfield story. Robert Carradine talked about having a mental telepathy type of power that he could shatter glasses in people's hands just by thinking deeply enough that when he was angry about something, he was able to shatter a glass in someone's hand.
Mm.
Catherine Bach, Daisy Duke, she talked about a phone call she got from a guy that she knows for a fact is dead.
Yep.
I'm trying to think. Mike Damone was Robert Mattis. He was one of the few that really ducked out of the way. Steve Hackett and him both ducked the heck out of the way when I went to the paranormal stuff. They both went running for the hill. I think Steve Hackett actually blatantly did something along the lines of, all right, I've got another thing to do now. I think he made an escape that dramatic, if I recall. We were doing so great with all the Genesis questions, and as soon as I made some kind of a switch towards, like, trying to tie Genesis lyrics to, you know, from Watch of the Skies to an alien thing, he was like, oh, look at the time. The Shadow Stevens, he had a weird story about that he thinks he worked for aliens. When he was serious. He thinks he worked for a family that he thinks might have been aliens.
Yeah.
When he was a teenager. I'm forgetting who else, but I mean, an awful lot of people have come in with things. Now, sometimes they've tipped us off before they came on. Like they sort of, I think Burt Ward's manager did this. I think he emailed us that Burt, I think the manager wrote something like, are you going to be talking to Burt about the paranormal? And we took that as, because Burt doesn't want to hear about that. You know, like we, that's when someone says something like that, we take them as meaning like, because that scares us.
Yeah.
You know? And we wrote something delicate back, like, no, don't worry, we have that handled. Like, that's not Bert's department. Don't you understand that? You know, and their response was, no, because Bert has a paranormal story he wants to tell you. And so sometimes that happens.
Yeah.
So then we go, you know, in a case like that, we're going into the episode knowing this isn't really off limits. Bert wants us to go here.
Mm.
So, you know, a lot of times it depends on whether we've gotten a tip off like that from somebody. You know, so there are times I record an episode and I'm thinking, a little afraid to go there with this guy. Like, I don't know what reaction I'm going to get. And I really delicately, you know, go there, you know, kind of giving them an out. Like, listen, I just want to mention this thing. It's a paranormal show, but, you know, you don't really have to address this. Like, I give them a way to sort of like escape back to the normal interview because I'm not sure what this person's reaction is going to be to this. But sometimes I know in advance. Sometimes, you know, we get that Burt Ward like tip off and we know, no, he's insisting we bring this up.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's good as well, because I mean, I'm often really impressed when you have celebrities and actors and media personalities who do have this honesty where they're quite prepared to sit down and say, I don't know what happened to me, but this really strange thing occurred. And one of my favourites is Telly Savalas, if you've ever heard his famous incident where he regaled a story before, shortly before he passed away. I think he did an interview with Australian television, David. And his paranormal story is one of the weirdest paranormal stories I've ever heard anybody say, never mind a world famous celebrity like Telly Savalas was. So it's interesting for me that I think sometimes it shows a more human side to these people that are often put on pedestals of celebrity, that even they can have strange occurrences.
Yes. Yeah, that's a great point. It's interesting to think like they're, you know, these sort of almost fictional people that have now stepped into your real life, you know, in that they're in the room with you on this podcast. They stepped off your TV screen or your poster on the wall and they're here. This almost fictional person has had real life experiences just like yours or just like the listener's experiences. And like, you know, it happens to them too. It's an interesting, you know, breaking of the wall. You're right. It's an interesting thing. I had some other thought on this. I can't remember what I was going to say. Yeah, you were saying something about Telly Savalas and I had a really interesting, insightful thought and it's gone. But hopefully it'll come back.
That's okay. So for you, David, obviously you started out in radio and you moved into comedy. So what is it about the weird and Bigfoot especially that dragged you into it? What got you into the subject? Because obviously you've got a personal experience or two in regards to weird things, but were you interested in this topic growing up? Was it something you'd been aware of? Because obviously for us here, often many people will mention things like In Search Of or Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious World as their kind of introduction to the scary, and that's what got them into it. But so what was it for you, David?
Well, I hate to be predictable, but that you just took my answer. It did start with In Search Of.
Mm.
When I was a kid, I did like that show. I found it terrifying, but I liked it.
Yes.
And I would watch it, and in its original run, I think it started in about 76. So I was really young, and I would, you know, I would be terrified, like head under the covers terrified, but I'd watch it. And if, you know, that show, the original In Search Of, was not just scary in terms of the subject matter, but people don't talk about this. It had the scariest background music. The theme song was scary. The all the weird synth music in the background, the wall, while he narrated. And then they had this crazy staccato, nutty keyboard thing that would happen on that show.
Mm.
I don't remember if it was in the beginning of the show when they first intro what the subject was, or if it was the end of the show. I can't remember. But it was something like, I'm not gonna get the lines right, but this is the kind of context it would be in. It would be something like, could all of this have been a Bigfoot? Dun, 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 dun. Something like that. You know, your hair was standing on end. Your pop tart flew out the window. Yeah. But that used to terrify me. I did watch that as a kid, and then later on, you know, I had like a pretty consistent pattern of watching, you know, shows on those sort of topics. But I wouldn't say I was like highly well read or highly focused on, you know, particularly on Bigfoot. I liked it. It was interesting, but I wasn't like super, super into it, or probably more into UFOs actually, maybe as a kid, than Bigfoot.
Yeah.
And then comes my real life. Then comes 2007.
Yeah.
And 2007, I live in Los Angeles. Okay. I'm originally from New York, but I live in Los Angeles. And in 2007, my wife and I fly to New York to see Genesis, who I'm obsessed with.
Yep.
So where Genesis goes, I go. So even though they were coming to LA just a month later, I of course had to go see them at the Garden also. So so we fly to New York to see Genesis, and because I hadn't missed a Genesis concert in New York in like a zillion years, like going back to like Abacab or something. I hadn't missed one. So I thought, I'm not missing the 2007 one either. Like there's a pattern here. Genesis comes to New York, I'm there. You know, even though I was living in LA now, I had to keep the pattern going.
Yeah.
So we flew, and then after the shows, we were upstate New York at my father's weekend house. I grew up on Long Island, but my father, you know, since I was a child, had a weekend place way upstate New York, like near Saratoga, in the Adirondacks. And we went up with him and his wife to the house. And the house is on a 55-acre property, you know, a couple thousand feet up a mountain in the middle of a plateau on the top of a 55-acre property. So there's no one around any direction.
Yeah.
And it's deep, you know, deep in the woods and way up high. And you have to go through a private, gated, locked road to even drive a car up onto the property. And this is my point here is I'm really painting the picture intentionally. Hmm. There are no people strolling by. It's not, no one could be hiking through there. There's no person that can walk up there. No one could be there. I want the entire audience to understand that.
Yeah.
Okay. So we were up there, and we were asleep. 3 o'clock in the morning. Well, actually, let me back up a little bit. Earlier that night, about 10 o'clock that night, my wife was standing on the balcony of the house looking through a telescope at the stars because it's so clear up there.
Yeah.
And she's not like this. And she kept coming in and looking at me, kind of freaked out. And then she'd come in and tell me she feels weird out here, like just as creepy out here. And I said, what do you mean? She goes, I feel like something's watching me. She was saying things that aren't typical of her. She's not versed in the Bigfoot stuff. So all that stuff really strange out of her mouth. And I said, well, she come in. Forget it. And she came in. And then later that night, 3 o'clock, 3:30 in the morning, whatever, we're sound asleep in the guest room. It's pitch, pitch dark, again, deep in the woods. And it's a log cabin construction type of house.
Hmm.
And something banged on the wall outside, right next to the window that was next to our headboard, next to the bed, right next to that window. Something banged on the wall outside at about 10, 11 foot height. That's where their hand would have been hitting.
Hmm. Yeah.
And I'm talking about banged on it like boom, boom. Like, I mean, if a human being had done that, not only would they not be able to reach 11 feet up, but let's say they were on a ladder even to do that.
Yeah.
Their hand would have shattered into dust to have hit it that hard.
Hmm.
Like it, no human can hit something this hard without, you know, needing several thousand pieces of reconstructive surgery on their arm.
Yeah.
Afterwards. Okay. And now when you get startled awake from the pitch dark 3:30 in the morning sleep like that, you know, it's startling. You wake up, but someone listening to my story might think, well, why didn't you go outside or why didn't you look out the window? The answer is because you were dead asleep. You were in whatever the deepest state of sleep is, the heaviest dreaming and the full blown sleep. And it's boom, boom. You know, you jump up in a way that's completely sudden and startling. And you're in the pitch dark and unfamiliar territory. And you were dead asleep in the highest levels of dreaming at that moment.
Hmm.
And so all we did is sort of looked at each other and went, what the hell? And just threw our heads back down the pillows. We just didn't do anything else but just kind of go, what? You know, and just fall back down to the pillows.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I can tell you now, had we opened the blinds right next to our headboard at that point and looked, we would have been face to face with a Bigfoot. Because I've had this story investigated by Moneymaker himself.
Yeah.
I've had the story investigated by his BFRO investigator for that region. I did a 2-hour interview with this guy detailing from everything I knew about the property and about that incident.
Mm.
And they categorize it as I forget their categories, but category A is like you saw a Bigfoot face to face. Category B is,
yep,
you know, you saw it 10 feet away, whatever it is. Mm. They categorize it as that was a Bigfoot, you just didn't see him, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And their reasoning was that nothing else could have done that.
Yeah.
I was in a known Bigfoot area, which I didn't know I was because I didn't know much about, you know, I didn't know enough of Bigfoot at the time to know I was. But
yeah.
I can tell you that I was no more than 40 minutes from Whitehall, New York.
Yes, the famous Beast of Whitehall.
Right. I was right down the street from there. I mean, Whitehall is so close by that I remember saying to my father after I started studying Bigfoot stuff and I went back to that story in my mind, I asked him, is Whitehall close enough that you ever go there? And he goes, oh, yeah. He goes, my father talks real New York. He's an ex-cop. Like, oh, yeah, of course. Like, and he says to me, he goes, oh, yeah. He goes, come on, Dunkin' Donuts. That's where you're going to go. Yeah. So, like, Whitehall is close enough for, you know, that's where you go for Dunkin' Donuts.
Yeah.
Okay. So I was really on a Bigfoot, you know, line there, straight, you know, path. And it also turns out that my father, when I asked him more and more about the property, he started telling me weird stories that sounded very Bigfooty. Like, he didn't understand their Bigfoot incidents, but as I started to study the topic and I would ask him about, you know, anything else weird ever happened there? And I'd say, did you ever see anything like this or that or this? Things started coming out of him that he didn't at all care about or think twice about or know were Bigfoot incidents, but I started recognizing them as such. For example, that he would, a few times he found deer dead on the property with a broken back leg and a broken neck.
Yeah.
And, you know, later on when I started studying the topic, I realized there's a Bigfoot killing deer on the property.
Yeah.
Or I started remembering that he used to put his dog in a pen outside of the property and they would, you know, we'd get in the car and they'd go, like, you know, to town and go shopping and whatever things we did for a few hours and the dog would be like an outside kind of pen on the property. And I remember the dog was very, you know, spooked and skittish and like not happy to be put in that situation there.
Yeah.
And she was an outdoorsy dog, but she didn't seem to want to be at that place. And so, you know, I don't know for a fact that's, and the dog didn't speak to me about it. So I don't know for a fact.
Yes. Yeah.
She saw something, but it seemed awfully peculiar. And that, you know, that incident really, really took me down the Bigfoot path. Like, not only did I start studying the heck out of it after that, I started, you know, reading like a madman. I became the guy that I was reading so many Bigfoot books, probably hundreds of different books about Bigfoot, that I remember being on a vacation in Riviera Maya, Mexico, with my wife. And we were laying on the beach at like an all-inclusive resort. And, you know, people do on the beach. They lay in a chaise lounge in the Caribbean. They read books, you know.
Yep.
And, you know, the couple next to us, you know, they're both reading books. And the guy down there is reading a book. And his wife is, you know, you know, playing on her cell phone or something, and my wife is reading a romance novel, and I'm reading like the Bigfoot of the Sierra Madre. Yes. The cover of my book is something insane like that. You know? And I just remember people walking down the beach, you know, and like kind of like taking a double take when they see like a Bigfoot staring at them from the cover of my book. You know, and I could see them kind of going back to their lounge, doing like the mumble to their wife. A guy a couple of lounges down over there reading a Bigfoot book. that's what I'm laying on the beach reading, but I really threw myself in. And then, you know, within a couple of years of that, I start comedians talking about Bigfoot, the podcast, and then now the Monstrosity podcast.
Yeah. I mean, it is interesting, and I can concur that it doesn't matter where you read a book with a Bigfoot on the cover, David, people tend to stare at you oddly.
Yeah, it's especially weird. I'm telling you, it just try it. It's especially weird, you know, when you're laying out on a Caribbean beach and the people look at you like, what the hell's with that guy? Yeah, they're just, it's not the Bigfoot crowd down there. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that is one of the benefits of having a Kindle, David, is it stops the staring.
Right. Yeah, because I think this happened to me on an airplane also. You're right. I think I was flying to Hong Kong or something. I think this happened to me.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember reading I was reading a cryptozoology book. It might have been one of Linda Godfrey's, actually, on an airplane flying back from holiday. And I just kept glancing to my side, and whoever, and the person that was sat next to me just kept reading this book. And you could just see them looking across it to his partner, like looking a bit worried, thinking he'd got the seat next to the serial killer on the plane or something.
And there you go, Linda Godfrey, we've had a mushroom.
Yeah, yes, you have. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you've had some brilliant guests from the world of cryptozoology, as you refer to. Obviously, Matt's making his return, but Linda's always somebody. I mean, Linda's been on this show twice, and obviously, you've also had the fabulous Doug Hychek, who's the gentleman behind Monster Quest, who I've yet to have a chance to have a proper chat with. So, do you often, obviously, with your deep interest in the subject, are there certain people that you go after? Because obviously, when I do my show, David, I've got a hit list of people I've yet to have the chance. I've not had the chance to have a proper conversation with Matt, but, you know, I've spoken to people, especially in the world of Bigfoot, people involved in the Olympic Project, Ron Moorhead, who's obviously famous for the Sierra Sound recordings, people from another guest we've shared, Seth Breedlove, Small Town Monsters guys, people like Ken Gerhard and Lyle Blackburn. So is there anybody that you've yet to have on, or that you'd really like a chance to have a chat with in regards to the world of Bigfoot?
It comes right to mind. It took me a half a second to know the answer to this question. David Politis.
Yes. Yeah.
I'd love to talk to him. I talked about this with Matt Moneymaker yesterday. When we recorded yesterday's episode, I was captivated by the Missing 411, The Hunters.
Yes. Fabulous
documentary. It's unbelievable. And I was explaining to Matt. Matt hadn't seen it. I was explaining to Matt. I said to Matt, I said, you know, you're a big proponent that, you know, Bigfoots are not dangerous. And when I was saying all this to Matt, I assumed he had seen that documentary. So I didn't, as I set the question up, I didn't know that he hadn't seen it. And I said, you know, when you watch something like Missing 411, The Hunters, the David Politis thing, I said, do you start to reevaluate that conclusion? Do you start to think, wait a minute, maybe I'm wrong. These Bigfoot seem dangerous. Because Politis, in my opinion, is making an excellent case in that documentary that these are Bigfoot abductions. These are Bigfoot incidents. These are Bigfoot. Bigfoots are responsible for these bodies that are turning up in different pieces on different parts of the mountain.
Yeah.
He makes a really good case that that's what's going on. And it's really hard to come to any other conclusion, quite frankly. So I said to Matt, I said, does a documentary like that make you start to reevaluate your whole Bigfoots aren't dangerous point of view? And I was shocked that his answer was an unfamiliarity with that documentary. And so it kind of killed the question. It became difficult to explore that question with him like I wanted to. And I found myself spending the next 10 minutes saying, no, you have to watch this. And he's like, where is it? I'm explaining to him where it's on Amazon. He's like, all right, I'll pay the few dollars for that. I go, no, I think it's free on there right now. He goes, all right, then I'll watch it today. Yeah. And then I, after like 10 minutes of this, I actually said on my own podcast, I go, I've just done the greatest commercial for David Politis' show. No one has paid me to do this. I've just done a gigantic commercial for his show, but it's that good. And I told Matt, I said, you've got to get a hold of me after you watch this and tell me your thoughts. And he said he'll text me and tell me. So that is the answer to your question, David Politis. I want to talk about that.
Yeah, I must admit that The Hunted is. There are a couple of cases in that are particularly spine-chilling. I'm trying to think of the particular case. I've forgotten the gentleman's name. And they end up... He disappears completely. And they find his shoes and his backpack.
It's unbelievable. It's terrifying. Terrifying. The whole show's like that. But there's one in there. The thing that caught Matt's ear when we were talking about this, the thing that he was really, really interested in, I think the story he most wanted to see on there, isn't there one in there where a woman ends up seeing like a Bigfoot almost appear in the way Predator does, the way the movie.
Yeah, it's Bruce McAbee's wife.
Right, and it's sort of like it's not physically there, but it's sort of like she sees the motion in the tree of a digitizing figure.
Yeah, she can see it shimmering as though, because I think she's in a deer stand. In right. the morning, okay. and she takes a picture of it. And obviously, Bruce McAbee is a very famous photo analyst, specializing primarily in UFOs, isn't he? And she took it on a phone. And when he examined the phone, the picture couldn't have been taken by that particular phone because the pixelation was different to the one that the phone did. And she was just saying it was just unnerving that you could just see this shimmering shape moving around her.
Right. Now, as I went through some of the basics of that documentary with Matt Moneymaker yesterday, and I explained, and I got to that one. Mm. That was the one that had him on the edge of the seat. That's the one you really couldn't wait to see. He said to me, if that's as you're explaining it to me, because this I cannot explain, because this would really, it seemed that like that was really going to shake him to his foundations about what he thinks Bigfoots are or aren't. It seemed like the possibility exists in his mind that that could really cause him to redefine the whole thing.
Yeah.
And I basically sent him off to go, okay, you need to go watch this second.
Yeah, absolutely. I must admit, the more I hear of the 411, because I've followed David's career for quite a long time, and obviously David did a lot of work in the Bigfoot field prior to starting on the 411 project, David. So he's someone I've been aware of for a very long time in regards to his interviews and obviously his fantastic YouTube channel that he has as well, where he does like a weekly update on certain cases, which some of them, once again, are very chilling. And, you're talking about people out with friends who vanish.
Yes. I mean, I don't know why Matt wasn't as aware of this series as I'd expect him to have been. He said to me at some point, I thought that's just about missing people. Like he thought it's more or less, America's Most Wanted or something. It's just some type of a, FBI watch list, crime show. He seemed to, it's flying totally under his radar, what it really is.
Mm. Well, yeah.
So it was weird. It was weird to be the one to bring it to his attention.
Yeah, well, maybe that's the presumption on that, I think, David, as well. Like you say, that perhaps he's just thinking it's just... I mean, because after a few interviews I'd heard of David's and a few things I'd seen, I just started automatically leading, thinking, yeah, that's Bigfoot.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he makes a really strong case in that thing. I mean, he's not trying to be overt about it. He's not trying to make that decision for the viewer, but what it is makes to the, and it just is what it is. There's no other way to explain what's going on there. And then of course the natural conclusion you'd come to after watching a show like that is not only is it Bigfoot, but then the next piece of it that you'd have to think when you're watching that is, and these Bigfoots are probably not of this earth. Mm. In other words, that's the only natural set of conclusions you can come to watching that.
Yeah. I mean, that is one of the strong points. And I know it's a criticism that David Politis often gets, but he certainly won't get it from me, because I'm happy for him to just present things and let the viewer make up their own mind in regards to their potential explanations, because often people will try and explain things and say, oh, well, it's this and it's this and it's this. And then the thing with the cases that he investigates is that it's not a one-size-fits-all, David. It's not an easy explanation. It's not all kidnapping. It's not all drunk or drugged-up people falling into water. There are some cases that are so utterly perplexing that it just makes you scratch your head.
That particular documentary, because I've watched a bunch of his things, that
yes.
particular one, The Hunters, is just, that's the one that really is mind-blowingly, the way you just said, it would be totally unexplainable, completely off the wall explanations, you know, don't make sense. It has to be the things that it seems to be. But by the way, that show also happens to open. That documentary opens with a case upstate New York.
Yes, it's the gentleman out with his family, isn't it?
Right. Now, that particular case is very, very geographically close to where my Bigfoot incident was. That's also within an hour of where I was.
Yeah. I mean, that one's quite heartbreaking as well, because he's a well-loved, well-respected family guy. And that's the weird thing about that one as well, is because they just don't find any trace of this fella, you know. And he's, what was he, 200 yards from, they were all in sort of spread out 200 yards apart.
Yeah, there was a lot of canvassing the area for days, walking up and down, you know, the what's it called, they walk on like a pattern, like a grid pattern.
Yeah.
I mean, they had state police out there, I think they had FBI out there, nobody found this guy. I mean, it's unreal, but I wanted to remember to point out that incident was very, very, very physically close to where my Bigfoot incident was geographically.
Yeah, and plus that one features the weird witness report where he says he hears like a giant trap closing, doesn't he?
Yes. Yeah, you definitely saw this show. I think I watched it twice. I think I don't watch a lot of things twice. I think I actually went back and watched it again. It's one of those shows I made friends of mine watch that aren't even interested in the topic. I was like, you just still have to watch it.
Yeah.
Because I knew that it's so compelling that I might be able to, you know, move some friends of mine away from like an apathy or disinterest or no thoughts in any direction about these topics into suddenly being like, holy crap, I think this is real. Like, yeah, I thought like I could do that to my brother or some friends of mine. So I made people watch that generally don't, you know, I never suggest shows of that genre to.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, how do you find it sometimes when normal people ask you about your hobbies, David? Because often, as someone that works in the real world as well, other than discussing these fabulously interesting topics and subjects, people will often look at me in a strange way sometimes whenever the conversation turns. People just, do you believe in ghosts then, Paul? Or, what's this about Bigfoot? As though I'm the resident expert, but clearly I'm probably the only person they've met who wants to talk about these weird things and doesn't give a damn what they think.
I don't get a lot of weird reactions on. I don't know if it's because I'm a comedian.
Yeah.
And people sort of assume like, oh, he's you know, he's doing this some kind of, you know, witty take on it all, and like, yeah, you know, like I don't come across like Art Bell or something, I guess, where they think, oh, this is something weird. Yeah. You know, like people aren't sitting next to me at a wedding, you know, turning in their wife's ear going, the guy next to me, some kooky Bigfoot UFO host guy. You know, like, well, yeah, thanks, Tommy, for sitting me next to this moron. You know, no one does that with me because I'm a comedian. So they sort of like, oh, he's got some silly show where he talks to like Batman about Bigfoot, and he has like, you know, he's right. Like there's probably a perception that I'm on there making fun of it or something. And, you know, and I don't need to go into detail explaining it. Some guy's bar mitzvah, you know, like, you know, exactly to what extent I buy into all this.
Yeah.
It's a little trickier with the TV industry because the TV industry doesn't understand that you can marry together, you know, my skill set and the audience will accept it. I've demonstrated this now in two hit podcasts, but it's the TV industry sometimes has a harder time with that. I think it hurt the pilot.
Yeah.
They think like, oh, some comedian, you know, making fun of Bigfoot, our audience won't accept it. No, you idiots. It's not a comedian making fun of Bigfoot. It's a comedian that's had a serious Bigfoot incident that he's willing to talk about in detail. Yeah. That's been investigated by the BFRO and checked out. It's a comedian that Matt Moneymaker, for example, would tell you, you know, is very knowledgeable on the topic. That Matt doesn't consider me to be like a lightweight in terms of my knowledge of the topic. Mm-hmm. It's just almost a coincidence in a comedian. That's just like another feather in my cap that I can, you know, maybe I also know how to be entertaining in the context of the topic. But it's trickier when you're dealing with the Hollywood crowd. In business settings, that's when it's been trickier that I have this belief system and this combination of skills and professional background. But in the real world, it also doesn't come up. I mean, I go walking into a baseball hat shop to buy a new LA Kings hat. You know, the person behind the counter doesn't go, "So what are you interested in?" And I go, "Well, actually, at the moment, I'm thinking a lot about Chupacabra." Chupacabra, what's that? Yeah, this doesn't. Yeah, this doesn't come up at McDonald's. So you know, generally I can fly under the radar though.
I mean, to be fair, I do find it very interesting that other than I think cryptozoology, especially in the UK, is a very unknown kind of subject, David, here. But obviously in the States and Canada, it's massive because of the lore and the history in regards to Bigfoot and Sasquatch. But I often find it very interesting that people, once they know I'm into weird topics, are very open to talking about ghosts or UFOs or strange things like that, far more than monsters, perhaps. And I've had the pleasure of being introduced to people who've told me about UFO sightings, of seeing ghosts. A lady who lives near my brother told me about her encounter with the Min Min lights in Australia, which was absolutely incredible. And so I think that aspect of it, I love the fact, I think, because people realise you're not going to take the mickey out of them or belittle them or laugh at them, they suddenly open up about these strange things, you know, like you were saying about earlier on with some of your celebrity guests, that they feel comfortable being able to be honest about it because they know they're not going to be ridiculed.
Right. And that is, I guess, why some of them are willing to come forward and tell me, make sure to ask me about that UFO incident I had. You know, but you're right that ghosts and UFOs in general, just for the average person, go down smoother than Bigfoot or Chupacabra or, you know, Mothman or anything else. Yep. Like that. Dog Man, for example, is a great example. I talked about that in the Tanya Ramon story I was telling earlier, but Dog Man's a great example of one that, like, I think is hard to put over on the average person in a discussion without them thinking this guy's some kind of nutshell, you know? Yeah. Because dogs are just so ubiquitous. Everyone has a dog, or knows a dog next door. Yep. You start saying Dog Man, you're really like, to the person who's not up on these things, you just seem goofy. It all sounds goofy to them.
Yeah.
Bigfoot also is, in the United States, I think Bigfoot is largely seen as a rural, you know, like, you know, backwoodsy sort of thing.
Yes.
The more urban person doesn't think about Bigfoot very much. Like, there are no Bigfoots walking that 42nd Street. UFOs and ghosts, I think, are the mainstream ones. They're the ones that you can put. Steve Hackett may not have run off the phone as quickly if I stayed just the ghosts.
Yeah.
I might have been able to get him to play along with it for a minute. You know, but you go to a Steve Hackett with Ogopogo. He's out of there.
Yeah. Yeah, he'll be like, "No, I prefer Tessie, and you know, no time for Ogopogo." Yeah.
right. So, I think you're right on that. I think you can put ghosts and UFOs over in conversation more easily. I'm not sure what else I can add to that, but you're right. You're right.
Yeah. So as you touched on there, as someone that's had an experience with a strange light in the sky, David, and I watched it for the best part of an hour. Whilst I am a very open-minded person, I went through everything I could possibly think that could explain it, from reflections to lights to Chinese lanterns to an aeroplane, to the point that I knew I'd seen something unusual. I'm never going to say I saw a UFO, but I saw something flying in the sky in such a way that I could not explain it rationally. What about you?
You know, looking at my watch, I've got some other things to do. That was my Steve Hackett impression.
That's very good.
The answer is, of course. I mean, you know, you have an eye for these things, and you know how to eliminate things, and other people would probably have written it off to something more conventional, and you know why it wasn't something more conventional. And I have a similar feeling about my own UFOs. I was driving in Los Angeles. I don't remember exactly how long ago. I'm going to say 3 to 5 years ago. Is a good guess. But I do remember, my computer keeps doing an update. So if you're hearing a roof, a dog barks when this update comes through. It's very strange. Anyway, really, I'm not kidding. There's a dog barking update that happens on my computer. So anyway, I was driving, and you know, for those playing along at home with Google Earth, if you want to take the drive along with me right now, you can do this by listening carefully to what I'm about to say. I was driving on Victory Boulevard in Los Angeles, heading eastbound, approaching Sepulveda Boulevard. So I'll give you a minute to Google Earth that, ladies and gentlemen. You can follow along with me and watch the sky, and you'll see what I was seeing out my windshield. So I'm heading eastbound on Victory Boulevard, approaching Sepulveda Boulevard. When I see in the distance in the sky, small dots, this is broad daylight, a clear, sunny weekday. I see small dots, silverish, kind of glinting dots, maybe a half dozen of them, hovering around each other, changing positions from each other, kind of, you know, maybe in a semicircle, and then two or three move this way, and a couple go over there, and a few more. Just, you know, changing position, moving around in ways that a balloon wouldn't be able to. It would blow one consistent way, or, you know, something that was floating, like a helium balloon would blow, wouldn't be able to change, wouldn't be able to now go back to the left, now it moves to the right, now it moves to the center, now it goes back over there. It couldn't do that.
Yeah.
And it also wouldn't stay in, you know, relative proximity to the other six. Like, you know, they're all like generally hanging around a certain portion of the sky over there, you know. So I'm watching this in the distance, and you can't judge because you don't know how high up they are, how small they are. You can't judge exactly where they are. But I'm going to take my best guess and say from where I was looking, they were like over Burbank or something thereabouts would be a good educated guess about where I think they were in the sky.
Mm.
And it caught my eye enough at the traffic light I was sitting at Sepulveda and Victory, that I thought, this is so strange. I'm going to pull over and stare at this thing. So I made a right turn onto Sepulveda and parked my car not far away from that corner. There was like some kind of parking lot that faces Sepulveda in front of like a paint shop or something, or some kind of home improvement type of store shop. And I parked my car facing the eastern sky, you know, where I'm getting the same view I would have had from that traffic light earlier, but just sitting still in a parking space.
Yeah.
And I'm just watching, and it just continues to be what I've been seeing the last few minutes, the glinting kind of silvery, you know, round objects moving around each other, changing positions at what looked like very high in the sky. And I'm thinking, this is really weird. I mean, I can't really explain what that is. And they weren't like big enough that everyone would have noticed them. They were so small and in the distance that you would not necessarily have just noticed them. Someone else could have been driving the same route as me and just not even have really noticed them. And if someone else did notice them, they might have just kind of not thought much about them because they weren't like big giant objects in the sky. They're like, that's a UFO. It wasn't like that. They were little specks.
Mm.
And then I thought to myself, all right, I got to continue on my ride here. So I was headed someplace to a meeting or something. I was somewhere I was going that I had to be at a time, you know? So I thought I need to continue my ride. And I carried on driving east. And thinking I'll still just keep my eye on it as I drive. And then it wasn't much further where I lost sight of them. I think I even called my wife during all this. I think during the parking space portion, I called my wife and told her what I'm watching, what I'm seeing, you know, but I continued driving and, you know, trying to make it to where I was headed to on time. And I did lose sight of them as I continued, say, another mile or so. I lost sight. And I don't know if they actually left or I lost sight or whatever. But later on, as I looked on YouTube and things for incidents like mine, I started being surprised at how frequently I found videos and saw TV recreations of incidents that looked just like that one. Mm. That the exact sort of thing I was seeing was previously filmed or reported as a UFO incident.
So, I mean, when it happened, when I had my experience, I remember being, after I'd gone through everything, I was so convinced I saw, because I couldn't comprehend what it could possibly be, David, I was so convinced I emailed the British Meteorological Society and said, I think I've seen a comet. And I explained everything, gave them a blow-by-blow account for them, and they just wrote back and said, no, you didn't see a comet, it lasted too long, because it must have lasted 45 minutes, an hour, this thing. And at that point, I just had no idea what I could possibly have seen then, because it was basically like a big ball of fire that I saw. Is it some kind of weather phenomenon that is only occasionally spotted? I don't know. All I know is I saw something odd in the sky.
Well, England's a cool place for that whole vibe. I mean, first of all, you have the best crop circles in the world.
Yes.
You have, you know, lots of country area with good, you know, good clear sky and a lot of light problems. Like, you know, just in the London Metro, you know, it's easy. It's very quick to be out of London Metro when you're driving in England. Yeah. And then of course, England is old, and like the United States, it's old and it's full of history and, you know, buildings that, you know, could have loads of ghost incidents. Yeah. It's just an older place. The United States is new and stupid. Of all the places I've been in the world, I would say the UK is my favorite place I've ever been.
Oh, well, that's very kind of you.
I'm not even talking paranormal right now. That last statement wasn't connected to the sentence before that about UFOs. And I didn't mean my favorite place because it's full of UFOs and ghosts. I meant my favorite place. Love the freaking place. Freaking love the place.
Well, I've never had the chance to get out to the west coast of the States yet, but I have an open invitation to join the Olympic Project. So if I get anywhere, it's probably going to be Washington State to start with, I think.
Well, actually, I'll give you another hot tip. Matt was going this weekend on an expedition in the Sierra Nevadas that he considered to be the highest tech Bigfoot expedition ever done.
Mm-hmm.
The tech that was coming with him on this expedition this weekend, he said, is the highest tech stuff that's ever been taken on a Bigfoot expedition. He was unbelievably excited about the prospects of what was going to go down this weekend based on the location that was selected and the tech that he knew was going to be with him on the trip. And that's something that we talk about on the episode I recorded yesterday, which will come out in July. But so who knows? We could be getting big Bigfoot news from Mr. Moneymaker any minute now.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, I certainly listen to that as I eagerly await your releases in regards to your show, David. So, firstly, thank you so much for spending some time having a chat with me. It's been fantastic to finally get a chance to talk things over with you in regards to your show and your work. So, where can everybody catch up to date with the program and find out where future episodes are coming and who else have you got coming up planned?
Coming up planned, I don't know yet. I just recorded the one yesterday, and I don't know that it actually is. I have some ideas because I know what celebrities have contacted us, and I have an idea who it could be, but I can't say for sure, so I won't. And then regarding where you can find all these things, monstrositypodcast.com, the website, is the hub to find everything about the show. From monstrositypodcast.com, you can get to the show's social media, you can get to my social media, you can get to you know, all the different bazillion places the podcast is distributed, which is, of course, all the obvious places that anyone would think it would be distributed. Hmm. It's all off there. So everything springs off monstrositypodcast.com.
Fantastic. Well, I recommend it highly. It's a brilliant show in regards to anybody that loves culture, entertainment, and also the weird. And I love the way you have the mix and the way you get your guests able to open up about a variety of topics. From underwear choices to avoiding Julie Newmar's sashaying.
You read my mind. I mean, you literally said what I was going to say. If you hadn't gone there, I was going to say, yes, I can get the guests to wear everything I want them to talk about, except I can't get Bert Ward to talk about Julie Newmar.
Well, David, it's been a real pleasure. I can't wait to listen to the upcoming episode and what else will be coming down the pipeline this year. So thank you again for your time. It's been a real pleasure to finally speak with you.